Hi, today is July 30th, 2016. This is Mobile News Podcast number 168. I'm Todd Ogasawa with my good friend John Westfall, and we are joined today by my good friend Don Watkins, who I've known, John hasn't met him in person, but I've known Don since 1995. It's been a while.
It has been, and thank you very much for having me.
Thank you. Thank you so much for joining us. You know, the reason I asked Don back, aside from the fact that he's a great person to speak with about pretty much anything, is that on August 12th of this year, the IBM PC turns 35 years old. And Don, for those of you who are on CompuServe, might recall that he ran one of the very first forums there, certainly one of the very first tech forums, the IBM PC forum, a bunch of others. I think there were like five forums or something he was running, some large number. I met him when we were both contract workers on the Microsoft network during its launch. But at any rate, a couple of news items, and then we'll get to Don. Two news items I want to mention. One, I haven't seen on my phone yet, but apparently the Google Phone app is going to get updated. Haven't seen it on my Nexus 6 yet, but what's going to happen, it's going to have spam protection for phone calls. So apparently once you get this phone app update on your Nexus phone or Android One, it's going to warn you about potential spam callers, so I'm really looking forward to seeing that. And the second item I wanted to mention is basically one of my rants, is that, you know, how Android is so fragmented and they don't update as much as Apple does. So, for example, my iPad 2 came out in 2011, and it is running iOS 9.3.3. It will not get 10, which presumably launches in October, but still, it launched 2011, it got all the updates until this year, so for 5 years, it's been getting regular updates, along with any other phone or tablet that Apple puts out that is eligible for those updates. And 5 years, you know what, that's long enough for updates for me. I'm happy with that. But I always suspected that there was some unofficial or official statement about Android phones, and I found it. So if you go to Motorola's global portal for customer help, I found a link, I'll put it in the show notes when I post this podcast. It says, Nexus devices may not receive the latest version of Android if they fall outside the update window, which is usually about 18 months after the device is released. So, there you go. 18 months after the device is released, you can pretty much expect no more updates. Not always true, but I found that to be mostly true. I haven't had Android phones for a number of years now, and basically, it means my Nexus 6 will get the, I want to say, Nutty McNuckface, but it's really Nougat. We'll get the Nougat update, and then that's it. It's over. Even though it's going to be, I've had it only about a year. Actually, next month I'll have had it a year, I think. But it will not have the update. So, a little bit disappointing. And you have a rant, John, don't you? Oh, did we lose?
Yeah, I do have one. This is something that we've talked about in one of our private news groups, but I just am continually amazed by Microsoft's decision-making. basically, as of the Windows 10 Anniversary Edition, that'll be out shortly on August 2nd,
yep.
You will not be able to disable certain forms of advertising in Windows 10 Pro. So if you have enterprise or education, the registry edits that are at the heart of this group policy that you can push out will still work, but if you've got Windows 10 Pro, you're going to get ads, which really, I don't know, for an operating system that as of today you have to pay for, this just seems really strange that we're living in a world where Microsoft is kind of pushing advertising on people, and then you've got Apple with OS 10 that is free as well for upgrades, but no limited time upgrade window and no advertising.
And isn't it also true that with Windows 10 Anniversary Edition, folks running group policies will not be able to block some Windows Source stuff, so the various games and things can be freely downloaded into your work computer, whether or not management wants it or not?
Yeah, and certain other really useful things for management customization. What basically Microsoft is saying is that if you are running Windows 10 in a business, you should be running Enterprise. You should not be running Windows 10 Pro. Which makes me curious, because then who should be running Windows 10 Pro? Because for years we've been told if you're running at a home office, then you should be just fine on home. Mm-hmm. And if you're now in the enterprise, you should be on enterprise. So really, who is Pro intended for?
Yeah, that's a good question, and we'll probably be hearing the screams starting next week.
Yes. Well, the screams that we hear are always the loudest, and so we'll see if regular people scream as well.
Right. Right. Okay, and speaking of screaming at things, the thing we're screaming about are basically PCs, which, as I mentioned earlier, on August the 12th, will have been around for 35 years. Hard to believe. And, you know, for those too young to remember, and I'm looking at you, John, the first, and Don, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but my recollection is that the IBM PC was the first major personal computing product that had like mainstream advertising campaign. So I remember they licensed a Charlie Chaplin image, and there were TV commercials splashed all over the place, and there are lots of full page magazine ads and things like that. And I don't remember seeing that for the TRS-80 Model 1 from Radio Shack or the Apple II or anything like that. Do you remember anything like that, Don? If there's anything preceding it that was major?
The only thing I can recall is perhaps the Sinclair. I think I saw a full-page ad for the Sinclair in the Wall Street Journal.
Oh,
but, yeah, that could have been after the IBM PC came out, however. I can't put a specific date to it.
Yeah, but it was around the same time. And, you know, I was just thinking maybe the Commodore 64.
Don't recall that one at all.
Yeah. Yeah, I think William Shatner was one of the – in fact, Bill Gates. Did Bill Gates advertise? No, he was advertising golf balls or something. but he was really – he was a spokesperson for like a golf ball thing.
That makes perfect sense. In some weird alternate universe.
But, you know, the funny thing is, in 1981 when the IBM PC came out, Microsoft was a relatively obscure company. Aside from folks who, you know, knew about their BASIC, or I think they had a BASIC compiler you could buy too, and a couple other pieces of software. I don't think anybody much knew about Microsoft. You know, they're kind of a behind-the-scenes thing.
Yeah, I knew them only through the Silicon Valley Computer Club. Mm. And Gates had come down and really complained about piracy of the BASIC compiler. And I think there were he had sold like 12 copies. Until they caught the deal with IBM to supply PC DOS, they were a very tiny company.
Yeah, and speaking of PC DOS, as John mentioned earlier, you know, Windows 10 Anniversary Edition is coming out next week, Tuesday. You may already have the bits in your computer. You don't know it. It looks like they're slipstreaming it, like they did for the Windows 10 upgrade from Windows 8. So come Tuesday, you may be able to upgrade relatively fast. But we'll see. But
it's well, and we've already road. Learned that that you already have it, whether you want it or not. That's the other the discussion point this week has been about the magical X button that actually apparently Microsoft interprets as yes, please install Windows 10 on my computer.
Yeah.
So yeah, you're gonna get it, whether you want it or not.
Yeah, in many senses of the word, get it.
Yeah.
I'm not going to say what I really want to say. Mixed company might hear this.
Yeah, we're rated G or PG at least.
That's fair enough. Yeah,
but it's been a long road. I mean, you know, it's been a long, interesting road from PC DOS 1.0 to Windows 10 Anniversary Edition in 35 years. And so I wanted to ask Don for his thoughts on it. I have a couple of thoughts, but Don was much more involved in the community than I was. I was more of a lurker, and Don was out there actively managing groups and interacting with people and talking to folks and doing important stuff while I was just kind of like reading his stuff. But anyway, so what did you get? What did you were you using before you got your IBM PC, Don?
Nothing seriously. Apple II. A TRS-80.
Yeah.
I tried the Sinclair, which seemed like a glorified programmable calculator to me. And who wants to type on a membrane? I never really clicked with either the Apple II or the TRS-80. And I think a lot of that had to do. Now, the Apple was a little bit more sophisticated, but all I had on the Tandy box was a cassette recorder for storing data. And if you've ever used a cassette recorder for storing data,
Oh, yes.
You know, it can take 5 minutes to load a 10-line BASIC program.
If you do it right.
If you do it right. And if you hold your mouth right.
Right.
So those machines never really clicked for me. I had always lusted after an S100 bus machine.
Oh, they're so expensive.
They were so pricey.
Yeah.
It always seemed like such a brilliant design to me. but could never quite afford that. And then when the IBM came out, it was like, okay, IBM's going to legitimize this market. And that's when I kind of jumped on, because it really, for me, it was the first computer I could really do anything serious on.
Well, it's interesting, you know, because I had a TRS-80 Model 1. In fact, I still have it. It's at my parents' home. And also I had an Apple II, which unfortunately I don't have anymore. I think I gave it away to a school years ago. But I really enjoyed both devices. I think I enjoyed the Apple II much more because it's much more accessible, something that the current Macs are not. In terms of, you could literally pop open the lid with no tools. You just use your fingers to pry it open, get access to the potentiometer. Actually, not a potentiometer, but the game port, essentially, where, you know, they had little paddles and things. I remember I built a joystick because there were no joysticks back then, so I used a stereo. Yeah, I grabbed a stereo potentiometer from Radio Shack and figured, you know, this is a two-way joystick. This is a two-way, I don't think we had the word joystick yet. It was a two-way paddle, right? It was like two paddles in one. So I figured I could do my games much easier. So I remember wiring that up and plugging it into the Apple. So I really enjoyed my Apple II.
Yeah, and you know, you're right. Accessible is a very good word. But with all due respect to Apple, and I think Steve Wozniak did some amazing things. For some reason, Apple DOS never really made sense to me.
It was pretty primitive.
Yeah. And it was, and correct me if I'm wrong, but if you wanted to copy something, wasn't it copy destination source?
Copy destination source. I can't remember anymore.
I know that,
but that sounds right.
Copy destination source.
Right.
Well, we read left to right. It's copy source destination. And I think I ruined more floppy disk and destroyed more work on the Apple II than any other machine I've ever used.
Right. And also on CPM, the copy command was called pip.
Program interface peripheral.
I think that sounds about right.
Yeah. And that never made sense to me. Not even a disk copy. If you wanted to copy a disk, you had to pip it using certain switches.
Yep. It was lots of fun, especially if you only had one disk.
Especially if you only had one disk.
Which was doable, by the way, for folks who don't recall. You would actually do in RAM copies, and you'd be putting this single diskette in, or two diskettes in alternately, like 20 times before it copied it. But it was doable.
And you got a case of carpal tunnel for free.
Yeah. Yeah. So when the IBM PC came out in 1981, did you go get it like in August, or did you do some research and wait a while? How'd that work?
Actually, got one at work because we had a relationship at work with IBM. Got one rather quickly. But even though I had a very sympathetic sales rep, for me to get one personally was not doable. So I had to go to Computer World, or was it Computer Land?
We had a Computer Land here, yeah.
Yeah, and wait in line like everyone else. And at the time, they were actually charging a premium because there were, you know, it's like a Tesla. there was, more people, there was more demand than there was supply.
You know, it's funny you mentioned that because I also bought mine through Computerland. I think Computerland was the official distributor for IBM PCs retail. At least it was in my neighborhood.
I think you're right because there was a there was another computer store, the Byte Store, I think is what it was called.
The Byte Store. Yeah, they sold that.
Yeah, in San Rafael, which was close to where I lived at the time, and I don't think they carried the IBM.
Yeah. Yeah, I know what you mean. You know, I bought mine. I was a graduate student at the time. That's how old I am. Some folks at the university unofficially created an IBM PC users group. So it's not officially associated with the university, but it was, you know, folks at the university, and arranged for a group purchase through Computerland at a slight discount. It wasn't huge, but you know, you saved a few dollars. So I joined that group and put my money in the pot to buy it. And you're right, we had to wait for, I think, months. They were sending it in waves. So, you know, it wasn't like 1,000 ordered and 1,000 arrived. It's like 1,000 ordered and it would come in 100 at a time or something.
Yeah.
And you'd notify the lucky winners, you know, that their PC had arrived.
That's like winning the lottery.
Yeah. Yeah, and it costs, well, yeah, and it costs about as much as winning, well, what a winning lottery ticket would give you these days.
Absolutely. I was going over my price list, and the system unit, which they had two versions, a 16K with mm-hmm. no disc and a 64K with two 160 KB disc drives.
Wow.
Was $3,045.
And that's without the monitor and keyboard, right? Or is that with the monitor?
That got you a keyboard.
Okay.
But then you needed a display adapter because it didn't have a display adapter. Okay. So a display adapter was $335. A monochrome display was $345. And if you wanted a printer, you could buy the IBM branded, which I think was a rebranded Epson, mm-hmm. was $777.
Yeah, and for folks who don't remember, the 5 1/4 inch floppies for that, I remember paying about $40 a box, and a box was 10 floppies.
Oh, they were ridiculous. I even remembered the computer land in San Rafael. They were such predators that I remember they had a separate rack of the Write Protect tabs, and they would sell you Write Protect tabs like 10 for a dollar or something. And man, those are supposed to come with. What's up with that? I mean, they were terrible.
Right.
They were just.
And for folks who don't want to do the math, let's do the math. So I think a double-sided floppy right away, or was it single-sided when it first came out?
It was single-sided. It was 160 when it first came out.
So a box of 10 is 1.6 megabytes of data for $40. During the Amazon Prime Day, by the way, I ordered a 128-gigabyte USB flash drive for, I think it was $15. So we've come a long way in storage.
And I buy, you know, multi-terabyte drives, sure, for $110, you know. It's crazy.
I saw a 4-terabyte drive at Costco for some reasonable price, and I didn't really need one, but I just sort of stared at it for a long time.
Well, you know, as you're talking about this, I'm thinking about the historic price per gigabyte, and I'm thinking someone had to have calculated this. And sure enough, in 2010, a gigabyte cost about 10 cents.
Okay.
In 1995, a gigabyte cost about $100,000.
Yep.
And in 1990, it would have been around $1 million a gigabyte.
Yeah.
Wow.
And in fact, you know, back in 1995, I was working for a large telephone company, and I went to its labs. Actually, it was GTE. And I went to GTE Labs, and I think GTE Government Systems was giving a talk at GTE Labs at the time, and they were running, I think, the Agent Orange database for the VA or some other part of the government. And it had 4 gigabytes of RAM that they used as a inline RAM disk to get the speed up so people could query the Agent Orange database at some reasonable speed. And you're right, it was probably $500,000 for that 4 gigabytes of inline RAM. That was basically acting as a solid state, very fast solid state drive. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, we have come a huge, huge, huge long way.
Oh, absolutely. And my first hard drive, I remember vividly because it was a 5 megabyte Devong, if you remember Devong.
I do.
Yeah, that was before the PCAT came out, right. And I paid $5,000 for that drive.
Yeah, I'd heard about it, but could not afford $5,000. That was just crazy, amazing.
And you were very limited on the size of the partition, so you had to keep doing these mounts and unmounts depending on where the data was that you needed at the time.
On a 5 megabyte drive, right?
I'm a 5 megabyte
drive. 5 megabyte drive.
So I'm very pleased with how storage has come along. It's really mm-hmm. amazing.
Okay, so, and I should note, let's see, my initial configuration, I went with a 64K system. I think I had a single drive or did I spring for two drives? As I said, I think I had to borrow money from my parents. But I did get the floppy drive because I, having gone through the cassette route on my TRS-80 and Apple II, I decided no. That wasn't going to work. I did buy drives for my Apple II and TRS-80 later, by the way, or before the IBM PC came out, but after I bought them. And I think I had, I really splurged since I was able to borrow money from my parents. I had both the monochrome display adapter and the CGA, which if I recall was 320 by 240 pixels. The CGA color adapter, which had, I think, a whole like 16 colors or something.
Yeah, 16 colors. Or 8 colors or 16?
Eight? Yeah, it wasn't a lot. And I know I had to do some like consulting for one of my profs so I could afford to buy a color monitor to plug into it. Which was a TV, by the way, not like a monitor, but you know, I had to use a little adapter to plug it in. Things we don't have to do anymore. Okay, so I know we discussed this in the last podcast, but how soon after getting your PC were you approached to launch the CompuServe PC forum?
Well, I started out, I got a dumb modem. Not the kind with the acoustic coupler, but one where you had to dial, and then once you got tone, you hit a switch.
Oh, I remember that. Yeah.
Yeah. And by the way, I had to spring extra for the serial port because the PC didn't come with a serial port, and it was $150.
I didn't remember that.
Yeah. Yeah. As a matter of fact, if you didn't have the monochrome display adapter.
Right.
You had to have a printer adapter because there was no parallel port either.
That's right.
There was one built into the monochrome display adapter. But if you had the color adapter only, you had to buy a separate printer port. But I did a lot of work with bulletin boards, but I got so terribly frustrated because they were usually single line, two lines at the very most. And you were just constantly getting busy signals and redialing. So I sprung for a Hayes smart modem. And, of course, by that time, there were some decent communication programs around that would do redial. But still, I would be redialing for 30, 40, 50 minutes. And so I got on CompuServe. So I'm saying within 6 to 9 months after I got the PC, I started doing the thing on CompuServe because it just, to me, it was the killer app for the PC. It was just something unlike I'd never seen before.
Yeah, it really was amazing to be able to connect your personal computer to the world, wasn't it? I mean, this is before, well, the internet was around in the form of ARPANET and a few universities were connected together in 1981. But for regular people, it was a dial-up modem. And I don't know about you, but I only had a 300 baud modem. I don't know, either 1200 wasn't out yet or I couldn't afford it. I can't remember which.
I don't think 12 was quite out yet, probably.
Yeah.
Because I had a 300.
Okay. Yeah, me too. And it was amazing to be able to connect to the world on these bulletin boards, even though a lot of bulletin boards only had one phone line, so you get a lot of busy signals, which is what the allure of CompuServe and other commercial BBSs that would later emerge, like Prodigy and AOL. That they had lots of modems to dial into, modem banks, I should say. So that was, and it was amazing to be able to connect to people and talk to folks and learn from people who you'd otherwise never meet.
Absolutely. I mean, it was the first, other than Usenet, in my opinion, it was the first, experience with the hive mind and being able to, you know, get information from other people that weren't close to you, weren't part of your local users group. And it was just amazing because I saw so many, other people saw so many problems for me that it was remarkable.
Yeah, it truly was. It truly was. So, you know, you were on CompuServe, and by on, I mean as a contributing forum manager on CompuServe for a number of years. And then in I don't know about you, but I joined, I was contracted by the Microsoft Network in 95. Were you contracted earlier in 94?
No, 95.
95, okay. So in 1995, Microsoft Network had not yet launched. And I think you were part of the first wave of people they contracted. I think I was the second or third wave of people. And we all met up in, I think you guys met earlier than me, but when I met you, I think it was in May of 95 when there was a huge gathering in Redmond. And Project Marvel, which is what it was called at the time, was about to launch. I think it was called Microsoft Marvel for some reason. What are some of the memories of that? Because it seemed to me that you had the Windows forum that you ran was like the largest, if not one of the largest forums on MSN at the time.
Well, I was kind of lucky because I had like the patent on the internal combustion engine. Everybody had, you know, had a PC, or the majority of users had a PC. So naturally they gravitated towards something that was affiliated with what they had. So I kind of lucked into that one. But yeah, Microsoft was a different experience. I guess my takeaway is I'm not quite sure that they really understood at the time what they were doing. I'm not trying to be unfair because it was so brand new. Not a lot of people did know what they were doing.
Absolutely.
And having been doing this already for over a decade, I felt like that they might have been more willing to at least listen to Not Invented Here, but they seem quite reluctant to do that.
Yeah, they, you know, Microsoft was in a state of flux at the time, in my opinion, you know, as an outsider. Even though I was a contractor, I was still an outsider. And they were looking to emulate the CompuServe or AOL closed garden model. They had not yet gotten the, I think, Charles Fitzgerald memo to Bill Gates saying we need to go to the internet. And MSN was not on the internet. It was very much like AOL. You had to...
Yeah, it was a private network.
Yep. And Windows... I think MSN came with Windows 95, which launched that year. And MSN was part of it. So anybody who got Windows 95 had access to MSN automatically through dial-up. Through dial-up modems. But so... And we were there for a while. I think when did they finally let us go around? 2001, somewhere around there?
I think 2001. We got traded to another team for a future draft choice to be named later.
Yeah.
And the future team immediately folded.
Yeah. That was ZDNet, by the way. ZDNet's still around, but they folded us.
Yeah, they folded us.
They didn't quite know what to do with us. But they did give us a nice bonus, as I recall, before it folded us. So.
Oh, yeah. It was a difficult time for people to try and get their arms around this.
Right.
And so I'm not being critical when I say critical things. And that's the benefit, of course, 2020 hindsight.
Right.
Well, and that was a difficult time because that was right when non-geeks, as we might consider ourselves, started really taking over on the internet. Where you started having people who had a user profile versus a enthusiast profile getting on. And so the companies, most of them at that time, were just trying to figure out, wait a minute, everyone loved this up until now. Why aren't they resonating with it? It's because users were a different beast at that point than they had been.
Right.
Excellent point. Excellent point.
Yeah. And the other thing to remember is that when I say 2001, this is pre-9/11. And this was like early in 2001. And for those who don't recall, in 2000, 2001, the internet bubble had busted, and we were in a free fall worldwide. We were going through, I think, what we would now call a recession. So it was pretty tough for everybody. I mean, you know, a lot of the dot-com companies collapsed, right? You remember, for those of you who remember pets.com and other, you know, ill-fated companies, the Amazons and those folks are far and few between.
Yeah, and the ironic thing about them were that they were, in many cases, those dot-coms that burst were ahead of their time. They were things that consumers did want. There just weren't enough of those consumers online yet to support them.
Yeah, absolutely.
I remember, in fact, during that dot-com bust at Amazon, I think their shares went to $18. So if you've looked at Amazon lately, they're no longer $18.
That's true.
But in addition to what John said, and I think what he mentions about the changing user is right on, but there was also a lot of flux in the revenue model. People thought they were going to make a bazillion dollars off of online advertising.
Yeah.
And sure enough, it turns out Google figured that out, but I don't think anybody else has. Maybe Facebook and maybe Twitter eventually, but I still think that's a very difficult space to be in.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's true. You know, I'm trying to think myself if anybody has figured it out, and it's a tough call. I mean, even O'Reilly Media, you know, which kind of started the whole advertising on the web thing, never did quite figure it out, and they've had to trim down.
Yeah. Well, I was, you know, let me ask you guys something. I was watching some ads the other night, and it dawned on me, I've never purchased anything based on an online ad. Have you?
I don't think so.
I've explored things. There have been a few times I know in the past, I don't remember what products they were, that I did actually learn about something new that I was actually interested in because of an online ad. But those are so few, I don't remember what they were.
I would be really curious. I just wonder, is online advertising, people that are paying a lot of money for online advertising, are they perhaps, I don't want to say, maybe they're wrong. But I've realized I've never bought anything. And it's crazy because I went somewhere and I looked at a pair of running shoes and I ended up buying them. But then for the next 3 months, all I saw were ads for running shoes.
Yeah.
No one wanted to sell me socks or, you know, some sort of medical device for shin splints.
Right.
It seemed so dumb just to keep trying to sell me a pair of shoes after I've already bought a pair. And it made me think, you know, is online advertising everything that it's purported to be?
Well, it's certainly, you know, despite Google's success, and they had a blowout quarter the other day, Thursday, actually, they announced their earnings, and it was a blowout.
Oh, absolutely.
And, you know, their stock jumped on Friday morning and all of that. But that said, yeah, you're right. And, you know, as a little person, as a non-Google, I know that I've had to deal with it in terms of, you know, folks that I wrote for whose revenues are dropping, and so they dropped the site or, you know, whatever, or cut back on a number of writers, all that kind of stuff. So I've certainly encountered that. And even on my personal website, there was a time when my little personal blog, which had Google Ads on it, was making about $100, $150 a month just from ads. I don't think I've seen a check for Google in 5 or 6 years. So, you know, it's went from $100, $150 a month in ads to zero, essentially.
Yeah.
Even though ads are still there.
Yeah, same here.
So,
no, I didn't mean to sidetrack us.
No. So, you know, kind of going back to MSN, because it was a good time. I mean, you know, we were there from 1995 to 2001. It was a nice run. I look back on it very fondly. No regrets having done it. And I always wondered with the big boys like yourself, with the huge forums. I had two small forums. I started with the computer telephony forum. And I later added the Windows CE forum, which people know better as Windows Mobile or Windows Phone these days. But, you know, you had the huge one. I think the desktop publishing forum was huge. There were some other huge forums there that were very, very popular. And what was it like? I mean, you know, I know we never really got numbers for it. At least I never saw numbers for mine. But just by looking at your discussion boards and stuff, I knew that there were tons of people there using the 10-to-1 or 100-to-1 lurker, you know, ratio.
Yeah, my disappointment there, and I did enjoy it very much, but I felt like it was in the early days of web programming, mm-hmm. and we really did not have any forum software that I thought lended itself to a lot of community. It was just so cumbersome to navigate.
It was.
That, you know, that was the thing about the CompuServe software, was not unusual for the PC forums collectively to run 2,000, 3,000 messages a day. With the web-based forums, the number was not quite there. And as a result, we never created the community. And again, maybe it was, as John pointed out, the nature of the user had changed. But I still participate in and appreciate a sense of community online with affinity groups for people that, you know, share a common interest, whether it's computers or cooking or gardening or whatever it might be.
Yeah, it was an interesting time. And you're right. We had some for people who never saw behind the scenes like you and I did. For a long time, we couldn't edit our own site, aside from posting to the forums. And when we did, I think we had to use raw SQL to update our sites.
It was cumbersome. Yeah.
So it wasn't like today. We have WordPress. You know, you open up a web-based editor and you edit something, you publish it, and you're done. It would, It would sometimes takes us days. I remember going to Comdex, and it was like a week before my Comdex report was up.
Yeah.
So it was a long time. You know, the last subject I wanted to touch on you on was shareware, because I know you were very, very involved in the whole shareware movement back in the 80s and 90s.
I mean, it was such a the commercial software market was really hard. I mean, software was really expensive. Mm-hmm. I'm trying to remember. VisiCalc was probably the least expensive program I can think of, and I think it was like $200. So shareware was an excellent alternative, and there was some really good software out there. And what a great way to find out if it was going to work for you, because you buy VisiCalc, you know, you're not going to be able to take it back. You have a license for it, and the store is not going to take it back. And it just occurred to me that was a wonderful model. And the thing that's so gratifying, if you think about it now, the whole world has gone shareware. Mm-hmm. You know, you can have a limited use or something that puts a watermark on the product or whatever, but you pretty much get to try everything these days before you have to buy a license for it.
Yeah, the freemium model is really a descendant of shareware, isn't it?
It is. Well, even commercial software is, you know, you can, I'm pretty sure you can do a trial run of Office.
Yeah, you're right. You can.
Yep.
And I can't think of anything that doesn't have a working demo. Now, maybe it only, like if it's a video editor, you can only use it for, you know, 5-minute video, or it puts a watermark. I guess Photoshop and the Adobe products are the only products I can think of that don't have a demo available.
That's true.
You could also, I suppose, make the argument if you've been a lifelong PC user, you can't really demo Apple software or OS X or Mac OS.
Yeah, absolutely.
Unless you go out and actually spend, you know, 23 hours or so at the Apple store.
But Apple does have that closed architecture model.
This is a Mac piece of software, but John might find this interesting. I was listening to MacBreak Weekly, and the author of BB Edit, which I think, John, you mm-hmm. use that, don't you?
I played with it years ago. It's not one that I use regularly.
Nah. Well, you know, he's over the years he's acquired or developed a number of software. And the other one is a free editor called Text Wrangler, which I used for many years. He calls it Text mm-hmm. Strangler, by the way.
apparently, have you ever here's a sidetrack. Have you ever read the manual for Text Wrangler?
No, I haven't.
It's at least 400 pages. I mean, there are things you can do with Text Wrangler in terms of reged search and all this other crazy stuff that's built into there. So I actually find the Text Wrangler has done everything I've ever needed for free-form text editing on a Mac.
Well, the interesting that he said that, you know, I brought to mind when Don was talking about shareware is that, so BB Edit, which is, so Text Wrangler is a free product, always free. There's no add-ons, there's no whatever, it's just the way it is. It's just a free offering. And it was kind of like an intro to BB Edit for many years, I think. Mm-hmm. But what he said, as you know, the author of both, he says, don't download Text Wrangler anymore. Just get BB Edit Trial Edition. You can use it fully functional for, you know, X number of days. I don't know, 2 weeks, a month, something like that. And if you choose not to pay for it after that period, it essentially is still a superset, or at least equivalent to Text Wrangler. So there's no need to stop using it. All the basic edit functions are there forever, regardless of whether you pay or not. So he said, just download BB Edit, give it a try. If you like it, give him some money. If you don't like it, keep using it. You know, like a mid-level text editor. And as you said, Text Wrangler. It is hugely powerful all by itself. So I imagine the BB Edit.
Yeah, I was slightly overestimating. The user manual for Text Wrangler is only 262 pages.
Oh, only.
Liar. But so Don, I know you were involved in the shareware things I mentioned a few minutes ago, and I think you were working with like Simtel or some other those kind of folks. And where are you today? Are you still doing some shareware stuff, or in terms of promoting it, or?
You know, I'm not, because I think that the world has passed PC software by, for the most part. And as you may know, Digital River pulled the plug on Simtel, I guess.
A while back, yeah.
Yeah, 2-3 years ago.
Yeah.
And I'm also finding that Google has their algorithm that seems to favor certain types of sites. And if you're, you know, if you're not on the first page at Google, you're going to die. And then in Internet Explorer recently, I found that all the shareware programs I have on PCNet throw up a warning.
Oh,
and Internet Explorer, that they're going to cause your machine to explode. So, and you know, there's no way that I can reach anyone at Microsoft to say, you guys may want to take another look. Some of the software is 25 years old.
Right.
You know, it's kind of tried and tested. But it's just too difficult, I think, for a small operation to have a big shareware catalog, because one, there's not the interest, and two, there's so many obstacles on the net these days to the entrepreneurial organization.
So you're forced to go to the store model, to the Apple App Store if you're on that platform, or the Windows Store, or that sort of thing.
Yep.
And you know, in a sense, I think it's actually, though, easier on Mac if you're an independent developer to still go the old shareware route, because for $100 you have your certificate that your stuff will run on a Mac without it. Even if you don't distribute to the App Store, you can still sign something that a person can download and run without any huge warnings, other than the basic, hey, you downloaded this off the internet, did you realize that warning that comes with, I think, everything you download on a Mac. So I think it's actually, and Mac users by and large are still more interested, I think, in desktop software versus a web app for everything. That's just my thought based on what I see around things like the app bundling that's very common on the Mac platform, right, which I don't know if any company that really does Windows app bundles
that
three or four do the Mac ones. In fact, I bought a Mac bundle this morning for one piece of software I really wanted, and then I got nine others that I might use, which is a great way of, in a sense, trial, because, of course, you put your later version, you know, if you're in version 3 and you're going to release version 4 in, you know, 2 months, you put version 3 out there for dirt cheap, and then you hook a bunch of people in, which is basically, you could think of as a form of trial before you buy.
Yeah.
So I think it's a weird world where I think now if you want to be an independent software developer that's writing desktop programs, you go where Mac users are, because they'll spend the money and it's still a little easier to distribute.
Yeah, and you know, in fact, speaking of the Windows App Store, and by that I mean the Windows Desktop, or what did they call it now? Universal Windows Programs. It used to be called Metro. It used to be called Windows Store Apps. It used to be called Modern Apps. It's
I call them useless, but you can call them whatever you'd like.
You can call them nuisances, but
But you know, the interesting thing is, so at work, you know, I have a Surface Pro 4 and I have Windows 10 on it. And I was commenting to some mutual friends of John's, we're on a email mailing list. I was commenting to some of my friends there that I've had a Windows 10 PC at work since last October or September. So not quite a year at work, although I've been using it longer at home. And, you know, I don't know how to log into Windows Store on my work machine. By that, I mean, I don't know what account to use. I know that my normal, you know, Active Directory account does not authenticate with Windows Store. I don't want to use my personal account, since there's a limit of 10 PCs, by the way, for Windows 10. And apparently now Xbox counts towards one of your PCs when you create an account. And my other comment was, well, so I haven't been able to, you know, download any Windows Store apps, aside from updates to to Microsoft's own apps. And guess what? I don't care, because there's nothing there I want.
That should clue somebody in that they have a problem. But hey, it's Microsoft.
Yeah. And that's not to say I don't want any third-party software for Windows. I've downloaded several, you know, what they call side-loading nowadays, I guess, you know, non-UWP apps. In other words, regular desktop apps I went to some website and grabbed. Like Microsoft, not Microsoft. Actually, I did grab Microsoft's version of R since they bought Revolution. So I did download, you know, Microsoft's third-party R, then downloaded, you know, Paint.net, things like that that I needed. But, yeah, there's nothing in Windows Store I need. It's pretty sad.
Yeah, I've been at my office. Now that I have a dual role, I have two offices. So I've got one of my old MacBooks at each office, but at one I actually use the Windows PC a lot more lately in the last month. And the stuff I've downloaded for it, by and large, I could probably count on one hand the stuff that I actually need based on, you know. So I don't know. It's still running Windows 7, so obviously I don't have the store issue that you're having. But it's interesting that back in the day, I used to download probably 20 or 30 little utilities and really customize a Windows machine. Mm-hmm. And today, the farther and farther Microsoft gets into kind of doing whatever it is they're doing with Windows, the less likely I am to really want to customize a Windows machine that I use regularly. I'm more likely to just go, it doesn't work the way I want it to. I guess I'll go use my own computer that I've customized the way I'd like it, or my Mac.
Yeah, that seems to be very common with most users I talk to these days. There's just been a glut of software, and people have just kind of gotten past that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, or if you install something, it's more likely to be on your phone or tablet.
Yeah.
Yeah.
A non-Microsoft tablet, I should add, because, you know, as much as I like my Surface Pro, and I like it a lot, it's my only PC at work. I don't have a desktop. I don't have another notebook. I just have a Surface Pro. That's all I have.
Mm-hmm.
And it's fine for that. But, you know, as a tablet, and I have a stylus, but as a tablet, it's utterly useless without a keyboard for me. I've probably used it for a total of, like, 60 minutes in the last, you know, less than 10 months in tablet mode.
Hmm. And interesting.
It was only because I didn't have the desk to prop up, you know, to type on. So I went into tablet mode to take notes, I think, but that was about it.
Yeah, I'm curious. I'll be getting a Surface Pro 4 for work in about probably a couple of weeks. The order was just placed. And the people I see at work that use the Surface Pro 4s, I've never seen them use it as a tablet.
Yeah.
It's always been propped up with the type cover.
Yep.
And
which works great, by the way.
Yeah, the stylus has come with the package that we purchased. So everyone I know has a stylus. They just tend to not use it in tablet mode at all. So I'll be curious to see if I find myself following suit, or if I actually use it in tablet mode.
By the way, this is a little bit off topic for today's topic, but not too much. When you get your Surface Pro 4, unless your IT group disallows it, try Windows Hello. The facial recognition works really, really well. And it works in the dark because it's infrared. It's not using visible light. It's also 3D. Apparently there's two infrared cameras, so you know it won't take a photograph. Or accept the photograph as identification. And unlike Lois Lane, it will recognize you with or without your glasses.
Really?
So it is pretty darn smart.
Wow.
You know, that reminds me of an interview I was watching a couple of weeks ago that was it was actually an interview that was done right after WADC for the Daring Fireball podcast. But it was talking about the new unlock feature that MacBooks are going to have with Apple Watch, where if you open up your MacBook and you have an Apple Watch on, you can just unlock without doing anything. And the conversation started along the lines of, you know, how do you prevent someone from grabbing someone's, you know, Apple Watch or whatever, I forget. It was like a local attack. And Phil Schiller basically changed the conversation topic to, no, we were more concerned about people with Bluetooth repeaters and like doing calculations of how fast should the signal be bouncing back and forth, and is someone relaying this over, you know, miles and miles of just using a Bluetooth repeater to get the signal in. I'm thinking, wow, that's a paranoia level that I haven't even thought to consider, but I'm glad someone's considering it.
Well, one more question before we let you go for this podcast is, what are you using these days as your PC, as your main PC, I should say?
I'm using a Windows 8.1 machine with a classic shell because I cannot tolerate the Metro interface on a desktop. Mm-hmm. I mean, talk about insanity.
Yeah.
But I am slowly but surely gravitating to PC BDS.
With the
KDE desktop, yeah. Hmm. The problem is there are a couple of applications that I use for video on Windows that just don't exist for anything else.
Yeah.
And I've used them too long. I know how to use them. I'm not going to retrain myself. I don't like using Wine because it in my opinion, it adds too much overhead. Hmm. So I found
the same thing, by the way.
Yeah. I do have three home theater PCs, and of course, because of Microsoft got rid of Media Center, they are staying at Windows 7, and they will stay at Windows 7 pretty much forever, I'm pretty sure.
Oh, that you know of now.
Yeah.
Until hopefully, one day you come in and they're at Windows 25. And
they have been locked down. There's no way that there is any code on those machines that can change the OS.
Yeah. You know, one suggestion for your Unix box. You know, I haven't looked at VirtualBox in a long time, but it did a pretty credible job of virtualizing Windows back years ago, and I tried it anyway.
I'll take a look. I did. Right when Windows 10 was announced, I did go out and buy a bunch of licenses for Windows 7. So if Microsoft will accept the key code and any of these machines die and I need to install a new version of Windows, I think I'm set. But I was very disappointed. I have no clue why they discontinued the Media Center. I thought it was a really nice feature, and it couldn't have cost them anything. Unless they just really want to get in the streaming business and felt like that was somehow prohibiting that.
Yeah, they want you to buy an Xbox is what it is.
Who knows? I cannot quite frankly figure Microsoft. Well, actually, I can figure out Microsoft, and I think that's the problem.
Yeah. Yeah, I think anyone who's been around long enough knows what their thoughts are. It's kind of like looking at a delusional mental patient. You go, okay, I can kind of see what you think the state of the world is, but I don't think the world is actually in that state. So you're going to proceed on your route, and we'll see what happens. I'll echo what Todd said. VirtualBox for virtualizing Windows has worked really well for me. I've done that primarily for my Windows purposes for the last 5 years and haven't had any problem with it.
And unless Apple has changed it, it is free.
Yeah, it is.
Okay. And I getting back to Microsoft, I have to think that they looked around and they saw the metrics that Google and Facebook and the like were gathering on their users, and their eyes just got real big and said, we're not missing out on that.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. I just find it reprehensible. But
yeah. And, you know, I have to say, after Ballmer was kind of pushed out and Nadella came in, they've done quite well from a financial point of view. You know, whatever disagreements we may have collectively or individually with their strategies, and I think we all have a lot of opinions about some problems they have with their strategy, they've been doing a lot better lately. So, yeah, they're seeing.
Well, and
fine.
I think they're doing an awesome job if you're not a Windows user. If you're a Mac user or an Android user, you're really happy with Microsoft. Yeah.
Yeah, Microsoft Office for the iPad is great.
Yeah.
Ironically, I guess.
Yeah.
Depressingly.
and the sad part of it is I have been a huge fan of Microsoft. I thought they've done a brilliant job. Not that they haven't stumbled from time to time. You know, the first two versions of Windows were pretty sad, mostly because I think the hardware was, quite frankly, not up to the task yet.
Yeah.
And then, you know, Vista and ME, of course. But I think overall, and the thing that until very recently, and mostly this was a change in hardware architecture, I could still run programs that ran under DOS 1.0, which is amazing. I mean, that's unheard of. And they maintained that for 20, 25 years. That's brilliant. And my hat's off to them for doing that. You know, I and correct me if I'm wrong. You guys know a lot more about Macs, but I believe that version changes of the OS sometimes required an upgrade of the application.
Oh, it was more than that,
yeah.
Because when they moved from, what is it, OS 8 to 9? And they changed hardware. They went from a PowerPC to Intel processors, or they were running emulation, then the emulation went away, so now you can't even run that old stuff anymore.
Yeah, yeah, it was a little longer ago than 8 to 9. It was .6 to 7 or something like that, but the PowerPC emulation went away, and yeah, Microsoft did keep the older stuff running a lot longer than Apple did. It's really only been in the last, actually, two upgrades from Mavericks to Yosemite and Yosemite to El Cap that I've actually not worried about upgrading on the day of release or even pre-release of the Gold Master, because before that, if I upgraded, I knew there was going to be at least two or three mission-critical apps that I wouldn't be able to run until they got an update from their manufacturer. So
yeah.
Apple has historically not been very kind with upgrades in terms of breaking things as Microsoft had been.
Right.
And speaking personally, I use Photoshop, and upgrading a Photoshop is like, you know, take out a second mortgage.
yeah.
So, you know, I've appreciated the fact that my old stuff runs. But I've just given up on them.
Okay, well, maybe we'll have you back to talk about BSD sometime, because I have not run Linux or Unix, and BSD is really Unix. I've not run Linux or Unix as my main desktop in 10 years, I think. So it'd be an interesting chat with you.
It is absolutely astonishing what people have done. I was never a very good programmer to begin with. I could write 100 lines of code, and a good programmer could come in and write the same thing in 10 lines. Mm-hmm. But it's amazing to me, and I can't even quite frankly explain or understand how people have become so very competent at writing code. It's just amazing to me.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Okay, so I want to bring this podcast to an end. This has been Mobile Views Podcast number 168. Our special guest was Don Watkins, and we asked Don to come in to talk with me, because we're two of the only people old enough still alive that remember.
Speak for yourself. I'm just an AI sitting out there in cyberspace.
That's right. I haven't seen you in person since 2000, I think. So
nobody has.
They put what was left of my brain in a blender and shoved it into a RAM drive, and here I am.
Yeah.
But it was good reminiscing with you. You know, it's it reminds me how far we've come in 35 years. And unfortunately, I don't think I'll be here in 35 years from today. But perhaps John can have a memorial podcast at that time, and tell us as if we were here what has changed in 35 years.
You'll just become an AI just like Don. Okay. We'll be doing this podcast in another 100 years where we're all just AIs. We'll talk about fondly before our mortal coil was shrugged off.
Okay. And with that, I will shrug off the podcast again, Mobile Views Podcast 168. I'm Todd Gosshard, my good friend John Westfall, and my old friend Don Watkins, talking about the IBM PC's 35th anniversary, PC-DOS 1.0, who nobody probably remembers either, but we do. Talk to you next time.